Welcome to And That's the Game Podcast. Presented by Pro Batter Sports. And That's the Game is hosted by Wayne Mazzoni. Today's special guest is Pete Walker.
Hello and welcome to this episode of And That's the Game Podcast, sponsored by Pro Batter Sports. I'm your host, Wayne Mazzoni. On this episode, we are really fortunate to get Pete Walker, former Major League player, current and longtime Major League pitching coach with the Toronto Blue Jays. And we covered a lot of topics from, as we always do, his youth experience with sports, his high school experience. Obviously, we talk about his college and his minor league and pro experience. But then we really got into a lot of what coaching major league pitchers is like and sort of the new technology and things that are used, and also his style and his approach with his pitchers and catchers. And really, really informative and interesting podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Great. So, Pete, so great to connect with you. And really, just to set up what this podcast is about, is two guys talking baseball. And ultimately, if anything that you can impart helps a young baseball player, a young coach, that's what we're really trying to accomplish. So kind of on that note, if you could answer sort of what was, and I like to say before high school, like the formative years, age, yeah, 5 to 50, what was Pete Walker like as a sports person? You know, was it just baseball? Did you play multiple things? What was your sports experience like as a young kid?
Yeah, you know, Wayne, I grew up in a very athletic family, come from a household, four older brothers that played, and a younger sister as well. So sports were a huge part of our family. I played basketball. They were very, very involved in football. They couldn't get me to play football. And my brother played quarterback. I was the youngest one. But grew up a real athletic family, basketball, baseball. Every season we played a different sport, and we had a very close-knit family. But, I guess in my formative years, I grew up watching and idolizing my older brothers. And I think being around the older players, for kids is always a benefit. And sometimes when you're the youngest, you get an opportunity to excel later on. And I think that was a benefit for me, sure. Basketball was a great love of mine early on. Larry Bird was my idol. It wasn't a baseball player. It was a basketball player. So I grew up, watching every Celtic game possible. But I loved his competitiveness, his leadership, his quiet leadership at times. And that carried on. I think I kind of took some of his traits into professional sports. Definitely one of the guys that I've emulated in over the years, and just work ethic and everything else. So it's kind of interesting when people ask me that question, your formative years, who did you idolize, who was a favorite baseball player, and it turns out it was Larry Bird. So pretty, yeah, good one.
Yeah, well, that's the listen, we're baseball guys, but we're sports people, and you can find inspiration in all different athletes at all different sports, no question about it. So that makes sense, Larry Bird. And I know you guys play a lot of hoops. It totally, makes sense. Yeah. What was in high school, in terms of now you're in high school sports? Obviously, you played baseball, but did you play basketball? And at some point, did you realize I'm pretty good at baseball?
Yeah, obviously baseball is my best sport. I enjoyed basketball a lot, but growing up in East Lyme, we had a real good high school program. Played for Jim Littlefield at East Lyme High School. He was, at that time, the program was one of the top ones in the state, I would say, and we ended up making it to the state championship my junior year, and had a real strong team there. I played for Jim Littlefield at East Lyme. I had a great class of players that I played with. I did transfer from St. Bernard High School back to East Lyme. One of my brothers, wow, graduated St. Bernard's, and that was, like, at that time it was a powerhouse. So I was the first one to kind of, make that change. I missed my friends, my close friends. Like I said, we had a great group of classmates and from an athletic standpoint. So I was happy to get back to East Lyme High School. We got to a state championship. I was player of the year my junior year, went 10-0 and hit over 400. So that was like my coming out party, I guess, when you say it in the high school baseball world. I had a lot of schools looking at me at that time. My senior year didn't go quite as well. You know, we had some issues at home. My father was very ill. He spent 4 months at Mass General. Mm-hmm. So I ended up, it affected my senior year a little bit, and I ended up going to Avery Point. So, you know, I grew up, like I said, East Lyme was a hotbed for baseball early on. You know, I grew up emulating my brothers and ended up at Avery Point for a year playing for Roger Bidwell.
You know, it's, you said something there I want to talk about, which is, you know, in this day and age, I'm sure you're aware of this, the reclassing of kids and the changing of schools in the post-grad stuff. And I, you know, I grew up, if you told me to leave my high school with all my buddies, I would have not been happy. So it's interesting to hear that you went back to East Lyme because that's where your crew was. That's why I'm not the biggest fan of this reclass, because the kids you played baseball with or sports with, your friends since you can remember, now you're leaving them. And I'm just, you know, not a huge fan of that. But so the great Roger Bidwell, by the way, I love Roger's a legend.
He's a legend. I learned a lot there. My brother Andy played there first. You know, and so I had a feel for the program, and I knew it was a really strong program at the time. And Roger recruited me. He thought, obviously I was recruited by University of Connecticut, Seton Hall, Virginia Tech. And I kind of fell into Roger's lap at that time. It worked out great. But, you know, I learned a lot about work ethic playing for him, you know, busting your ass and not saying boo and just doing your job. And also learned how to long toss on, you know, out on the hill at Avery Point. So that's when my arm started to get a little bit stronger as well. But I was more of a hitter back then, and pitching I did, but it really wasn't my first love. I liked to hit, play the field, and it felt more like an everyday player.
Yeah.
And that's what I did at Avery Point, and had a great time playing for Roger. I was only there 1 year, and then went to the University of Connecticut played for Coach Balak up there for a couple more years.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about that experience. I mean, I've known Andy. Landy's another legend. Awesome guy, you know, still probably throwing batting practice. Could be doing it right now for all we know. Yeah, how about that experience?
He is incredible. I just talked to him the other day. I was hoping to meet him and going to the UConn-Providence game tomorrow night. And Coach Balak was going to meet me up there and show me the football facility, which I haven't seen yet. But he's a little under the weather this week, so we're not going to make that happen. But he was great. He gave me the ball at UConn. I was a two-way player at the time. You know, I played the outfield, a little first base, a little DH, and pitched. There was an injury on our Southern trip my sophomore year, and I ended up spot starting. I believe it was Wake Forest, and I think I threw a complete game. I think that was the beginning of the end of my hitting career. I still hit a little bit my sophomore year, but I never came out of the rotation. He gave me the ball to start a game, and basically didn't take it back until after the game. You know, so it was one of those deals. I had a lot of complete games up there. He pushed me. He worked with me on my delivery. You know, we worked on a changeup a little bit, but the biggest benefit was just the long toss again. Started at Avery Point, got at UConn, strengthened my arm, started to throw the ball 90 plus miles an hour, and I guess the rest is history there. But I enjoyed my time at UConn. Andy Balak is the best. And, you know, I'm very lucky to play for guys like Roger Bidwell and Andy Balak, for sure.
And then obviously, you know, talk a little bit about, you said the rest is history, but let's just go through a little bit, talk a little bit about after college, you know, minor league pros. Talk about, you know, that experience as you look back on it now.
Yeah, I can't believe I'm you know, as you know, you've been in the game a long time. I've been in the game a long time, and it's kind of crazy. You look back, and it was, you know, 35 years ago that I was drafted by the New York Mets. It's amazing how time flies, and I'm still in the game. So I don't know how I've done it, but I've been fortunate enough to play for 18 years. And now I'm coaching. It's my 13th or 14th year coaching at the major league level. Been very fortunate. But yeah, I was drafted by the New York Mets. Had a normal rise, I guess, to the big leagues for guys that eventually get there. It took me like 4.5 years. You know, I played in A-ball, AA, AAA, you know, had some bumps and bruises along the way. Went from a starter to a reliever, and then finally got my call up in 1995 with the New York Mets. So it was, you know, again, going into professional ball, I was very naive. It wasn't like it was my passion to become a professional baseball player. I happened to be pretty good at my craft, and just things kind of, you know, transpired and worked that way. But once I got in, I realized that I could compete with these guys at each level. It kind of took that step. Once you get to make that step, you realize I can do this and I can play with these guys. And I was fortunate enough to get to the big leagues, and, you know, with the New York Mets, it was kind of a dream come true. You know, that didn't work out well in New York. They traded me to San Diego, bounced around a little bit in the minor leagues, went through a shoulder surgery, was close to retiring. And then fortunately kind of got a second chance with the Mets. They turned me into a starter with John Gibbons there at the time in 2001. And then I had my breakout year really in professional baseball in AAA with Norfolk. I went 13-4 as a starting pitcher. They called me up to the Mets again. And I guess the following year I was with the Toronto Blue Jays and spent 5 years there. So I was very fortunate to get kind of a second crack at baseball after that shoulder surgery.
What was the exact, you know, procedure that was done?
I had a labrum tear. I had a little subacromial decompression. I had a couple of things done. I had, you know, four anchors in there. So it was a pretty significant surgery. It's the shoulder's a tough one. You know, Tommy John, elbows now, guys seem to come back and seem to come back better than ever. I was fortunate enough never have an elbow injury, I guess. But, you know, looking back, I probably needed one about 10 years in, might have helped me. I lost my fat. I mean, I really lost my velocity. But I had my most success at the major league level, you know, after the age of 31. I was throwing 88 to 90. In my early years, I was, you know, I'd get it up to 95, 96. But was erratic, you know, inconsistent, you know, just kind of a pitcher without a real path or direction. I got a second chance, kind of reinvented myself as a pitcher, sinker, slider, split, and just located the ball. It was kind of the Greg Maddoxes of the game and guys that really had to locate and move the ball around. I was definitely a poor man's Greg Maddox, but that's what I did my last 4 years in the big leagues.
And obviously you mentioned Bidwell and Baylock were there. And I think also a good lesson is, hey, you're reinventing yourself. You're probably in the minors and in the pros, you realize, hey, this is my career. I got to take ownership of it. But through that journey, was there someone that impacted you in terms of your development?
Yeah, you know, I didn't mention the Rockies. I played with a number of teams. Padres and the Rockies. I even spent a little time with the Red Sox in AAA in that between time in those late 90s. But I signed with the Rockies. I was pretty much out of baseball. I had one team that was interested in signing me in 1999. It was the Colorado Rockies. They offered me. They couldn't guarantee me a AAA spot. They offered me, the potential to a working agreement with Mexico. So if I didn't make the AAA team, they're like, would you go to Mexico and pitch and kind of be in our depth pitcher for us? I said, sure, but I had no intention of doing that. If I didn't make the AAA team, I was coming home to my wife and daughters. Yeah. And that was it. And I would be doing something totally different today. But I ended up coming into camp with the Rockies. I kind of hit it off with Jim Wright. He was the pitching coach there in AAA. I had a great spring training. I don't think I gave up a run in about 13 or 14 innings. I made the AAA team. And then he worked with me all season and turned me, you know, we worked. That's when I kind of reinvented myself. I took my bigger slider and made it like a small cutter. I took my four-seam fastball and made it into a sinker. We went with a two-seam grip. It was kind of pitch design before pitch design.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Yeah. Yeah. You know?
And we developed a split finger fastball. So that's really where it all changed for me. And I had a lot of fun doing it. And they gave me the confidence to, hey, this might be a little trial and error, but they stuck with me. And I had a good season that year and came back and had an even better one with them the following year and got to the big leagues. So Jim Wright.
Okay, good. Yep. And at what stage, you know, obviously been coaching a long time now, as you were a player, did you foresee the coaching route after, or how did that come about that you transitioned?
You know, I got to be honest, I didn't see myself coaching after baseball, after playing. It had been 18 years. I figured I'd come home and my brother started a baseball and softball training center called America's Game. I was doing that part-time in the wintertime. Came home and we did it for a little bit of, you know, I did it for about a year and just realized that it's tough to just work in a cage all the time, you know, or, you know, we didn't have travel teams. It was more, you know, pitching camps and individual lessons. And it was a grind, to be honest with you. And I give a lot of respect and credit to the facilities out there and the guys that are busting their butts for hours on end. But it really wasn't for me. And at that point, I decided to take the coaching opportunity with the Blue Jays that was offered. And JP Ricciardi talked me into it. At the time, he was the GM. He thought I'd be really good at it. And I started coaching, and then had it quickly. I was very fortunate because there are some coaches in professional baseball, it takes years for them to get an opportunity. And it only took me a few years before I was in the big league. So very fortunate.
But that's interesting how you really didn't, in essence, say, I'm going to be a big league pitching coach as you were a player. Obviously, Ricciardi comes and gives you that opportunity. So that's fantastic. How about, you know, that transition right in the beginning? Did that come natural to you to start coaching, or was it a process, you know, to learn how to coach guys after you'd played so long?
You know, I think it kind of just evolves. I think, you know, when I think of my career, I didn't see myself as a professional baseball player. I didn't see myself as a major league baseball player. I didn't see myself as a major league coach. But you don't realize how much you know until you kind of are in front of somebody and you're talking baseball, you know, and then you're like, geez, I've been around a long time. I know quite a bit. So I think the fact that I played in the major leagues certainly helped in the coaching aspect. It kind of gives you the instant respect, but you got to keep it. So, you know, I think, you know, some of the best coaches certainly didn't play in the major leagues. I know that, you know that. And some of the best coaches have, in fact, never set foot even in professional baseball. Right. So I think players at the major league level, though, do like the idea of having someone that's been there when they're talking about going through tough times. But you certainly got to continue to earn their respect as a coach. And, you know, you got to constantly be learning. You got to constantly, you know, working with the individuals on improving their game in certain aspects. You certainly need to know that from today's standpoint, especially this isn't early on, but now today, the technology and understanding it and being able to implement it. But back then it was more just the relationships. I always felt like you have to form a good relationship. And I thought back to all the coaches that I've had that I liked, that I got something from. And there were always people that I could have a conversation with. The ones that I didn't get along with or I didn't get much from, for some reason, they might have been just as smart, but they didn't connect. So I think as coaches, as you know, that making that connection with the players, being able to relate, being able to have a conversation outside of baseball is critical. And then when you do have something to say, they tend to listen a little bit more when it's something baseball related, whether it's adjusting a pitch, whether it's adding a pitch, subtracting a pitch, whether it's changing their arsenal, changing how they approach pitching. So I think that's been something I take a lot of pride in. And I think that's something that, again, us being in the game for so long, you just learn things. It's kind of a natural evolution to learning the game.
Did the advent of the technology, was that difficult, intimidating? Did you have to learn it on your own? Did the Blue Jays say, hey, this is the new wave now, Pete, here's how we're going to teach you how to use it? How did that, because that part, I have to be honest, that's a little intimidating to me too, to read the data and the spin, you know. So how did that come about as part of your coaching?
I'm fortunate. I mean, we've seen huge changes in the game. When I was first with Toronto as a major league pitching coach, I mean, I remember being on our bats program and just spending hours breaking down hitters, looking at different things and, you know, from a data standpoint. And it was pretty much me, to be honest with you. And over time, changed. Our department's grown. Our analytical department's grown. I'm surrounded by a lot of smart people, smarter people than me. I'm not afraid to say that.
Right.
You know, I wasn't offended by some of the things that were being implemented in the game. I wanted to learn about it. Do I know everything? No. And I leave that to certain people. I'm not afraid to delegate in certain areas, but it is. You have to have some understanding on a basic level for sure of what's going on. You know, when you're talking about horizontal and vertical movement, the different, you know, shapes of pitches and, you know, so, but I do surround myself with quality people. And I've been very fortunate in that aspect. So I think the players understand my strengths, but we do have some people, we have a lab, you know, we have people working in the lab. I'm certainly not in the lab 6 hours a day in spring training, but I will touch base with the guys in the lab when we send pitchers in there. We'll talk about things that they're working on. So now that I can carry that into my side sessions. But I do think there's a good relationship between both where nothing is forced on me. I get to kind of sift through everything. and make decisions. And I think this organization has been very good in that aspect. They trust me. You know, Ross Atkins, our GM, Mark Shapiro, they understand what my strengths are as a pitching coach and have never forced that part of the game on me and said, you got to totally change and be this guy. So, again, I think I have a good balance. And I think our pitchers kind of respect that.
And that's interesting. Something I guess I hadn't considered is, you know, you being the major league pitching coach, you don't have to absolutely know every. You have people that can help. And like you said, you have a lab and you have people that are young and probably brought up on technology. Maybe they didn't pitch in the big leagues, but they know how to, you know, they're high level people that can help that. And probably your job is to interpret that. And how do we actually put that into play? So, you know.
But it's true because it's changed. You know, the game has changed so much. You look over the last 10 years and how we approach pitching and hitting and everything else. It's just it's insane the changes that have happened. But it's still the same game. And I think that's where, you know, we get caught up. It's still the same game. You know, it's about avoiding contact or you know, forcing weak contact and
right.
And ways to do that. So, you know, I know strikeouts are real. They're what everybody talks about, but, you know, I love strikeouts, but, you know, I'll take weak contact any day.
So you kind of alluded to this, but maybe you'll answer it in a different way is out of all the responsibilities of a major league pitching coach in your position, what's the day to day or year long things? Is it how much are we talking mechanics? How much is it arm care, strength training, strategy, scouting reports? What falls under the things that occupy your time with your pitchers?
I would say a little bit of everything, but obviously during the season, you know, major league level, when it comes to pitching deliveries and pitching mechanics, guys are fairly sound. So that's a good thing. So I don't have to spend a ton of time on breaking down a delivery, making adjustments. There'll be tweaks. There'll be little adjustments, arm slots, stride length, you know, direction that we'll stay on top of. But there's never really mass changes. That's usually done at the minor league level. But still, there are subtle changes and adjustments we'll make. But most of it's game planning, in-game adjustments, knowing the opposing team, the opposing hitters, knowing how to combat their swing, taking our strengths and really utilizing our strengths against the lineup, whether it's the Yankees, the Red Sox, you know, good major league hitters. So I think that's probably we spend the most time on advanced reports and game planning and coming up with a solid game plan for our starting pitchers especially. And then having a good game plan with the relievers that are coming in and obviously that's where I got to have a good relationship with my bullpen coach and pitching strategist. So we make sure that everybody's on the same page and has a good feel for the opposing team and how we're going to attack them. So this kind of a general approach and then kind of more of an individualized approach for each guy. So that takes a lot of time. The fundamentals are still important. I find that I think for 3 or 4 years, I think professional baseball has gotten away from the fundamentals of the game, where we're more concerned with, you know, velocity and spin and just blowing guys away and throw it as hard as you can. And I think, you know, we got away from fielding your position, learning how to field the bunt on the third base side, footwork, your instincts for the game. Understanding, you know, throwing the bases, recognizing speed on the bases, holding runners, you know, times to the plate, slide steps. So I think the past 2 or 3 years we've gotten back. I know our organization has, you know, we've spent a lot of time pushing that again and making sure our minor league coaches are really staying on top of these things because I feel in baseball we've gotten away from it.
Now, on what you said, which is very interesting, on the strategy and the game planning. So obviously you've got, you know, probably as a series comes up, the starters, the relievers, you got all the catchers, the coaches. But still, when it comes to actually calling pitch by pitch, it's still really the catcher is either calling the entire game / the pitcher shaking off. You're obviously not going pitch by pitch calling that. Right. So is that the case? It's really you're educating the catchers and pitchers on what the game plan is?
Absolutely. We have good smart. They have smart catchers. That's one thing that I know it's different in high school and college at times. Certain universities, certain high schools, where the coaches really take over the pitch calling, and that's fine. I just think it's I think with us, it's I like the catchers to have feel. I like the pitchers to have feel to understand what they're trying to do, to not feel obligated to make a certain pitch in a certain count, to trust their instincts. But I think if we give them enough information, if I give them enough information, I like to give them a little freedom. And I think we've always done that. There is a game plan. I mean, there are certain hitters where we're not going to get burned with certain pitches. We're not going to get burned in certain areas, based on what they have and what that hitter has. But within that realm, I make sure that they have some freedom. The catcher has freedom to feel something. He can recognize maybe an adjustment the hitter's making right there, whether it's, he feels like he's sliding up in the box, even though it's not something that we can see with the naked eye, or he just recognizes his hips, what he's doing with his swing. So I do, like Dan Jansen, Alejandro Kirk, and I've been around good catchers over the years with Russ Martin. He was one of the best, and to be able to work with him on a daily basis was awesome. So I've always given them freedom, and I think they've respected me for that. So I think our conversations have gone even better at times. There are certainly times where I don't agree with a call. We'll have a tough conversation, right. A very fun conversation. But I think in between innings, we have conversations about who's coming up next, how we're going to attack them. So I think it just gives them, it's not scripted, but they have a plan for each guy, and I guess if from a coaching standpoint, maybe if we didn't have necessarily a plan, it'd be easier for me to just call pitches from the bench. But I feel confident in our plan, in our strategy, in our advanced reports, and then in our catchers and pitchers to execute pitches.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I'm not still in the college game coaching now, but I coached pitchers for 30 years in college and called a lot of pitches. And then I got smart and came up with something that I think I came up with that I do actually see being used now, even in the big leagues, which is had this one really good smart catcher. And I said, well, hey, you have the feel. What I'm going to do is I'm going to write our plan of attack on each hitter on the other side on your wrist. And then he would look down, hey, number two, because, obviously in the college, you don't have the same reports. You don't have the same time. So and then the guy would look down and say, all right, this is how we're going to approach this guy. So I see that happening now in the big league. Is that relatively new, 10 years?
I didn't hear the last part of that question.
It's about how long has it been that the catchers are kind of wearing those scouting reports?
Yeah, it's been a few years at least. We started doing it it's been in baseball probably 5 or 6 years, I guess. The first team just started it. But we've been doing it for the last few years, maybe 4 years as it is. And it's been really good. Again, they're suggestions, but it does give them a little bit of a blueprint. So if they get a little bit rattled, they're not sure what to call because we're not calling it from the bench, although we do have signs. So if they're really in a pinch, there are certain things that I'll do to the catcher. He'll look at me and in a certain tough situation, a guy's been fouling off 3 or 4 pitches and I'll give him, we have different signs that I'll give him right there, whether to go to the breaking ball again, to bounce a breaking ball, to elevate a heater. So I do have things that I'll give him from the bench, but that card gives him a lot of options. And so when those situations do arise, it's amazing what's on those cards. If you looked at every organization, every team's probably different. But there's a lot of information on there. So those catchers, it can be overwhelming at times. We try to simplify it as much as possible. So in a key situation, they can take a quick look and be like, all right, I'm going with that. Whether it's it'll show like an area that the hitter's really weak or in a 2-strike count where he's weak. And they can kind of go to that pitch. And if we can execute it, we have a good chance to get him out.
Right. So, yeah, obviously you have the information, then you have, the execution. All right, this is a good time. We'll take a little short break here with Pete Walker, and we'll be right back.
Introducing ProMatter, the future of baseball training. With the PX3, you can practice like you play. There is a better way to train your athletes. With an easy-to-use touchscreen controller, you can program any pitch, any speed, at any location. The ProMatter simulator is designed to replicate real game, real-world pitching. Better practice, better play. Hit any spot inside or outside the strike zone. The PX3 features reliable mechanics and an optional automatic ball feeder system. Get the most from practice. In addition to baseball, the PX3 is perfect for softball. With the PX3, no more relying on practice pitchers or basic pitching machines. Better practice, better play. ProBatter. train like it's game day. Step up to the plate with confidence.
Hello, this is Wayne Mazzoni, host of And That's the Game podcast. I hope you're enjoying listening and watching the podcast as much as I am making it. It's really been enjoyable to connect with all these great people, great baseball people. The purpose of this message is to let you know about College Baseball Advisors, a company that I founded a couple years back after 30 years as a college baseball coach. I basically guide players and families through the recruiting process. If you're interested in learning more, please go to collegebaseballadvisor.com and learn more, or book a call where we basically will meet and talk about your recruiting process. I'll lay out a three-step plan for you to move forward. If after that call you think I'm someone that could help you in this process, we can discuss that. If not, you just want to take that information and use it to go forward, that's great as well. So hope to see you down the road. Thank you. Okay, we're back with Pete Walker, Major League Baseball pitching coach for the Toronto Blue Jays. Pete, we're going to cover two more topics and on this. The first is, what is your responsibilities, if any, which I assume there are, for minor league pitchers? Are you getting reports from the pitching coaches, from looking at video? What responsibilities do you have for guys not on the big league roster at the minor league level?
Yeah, we do. We're very aware of what's going on, especially in Double A and Triple A, because that's our depth. You know, our Double A team sometimes has some of our top prospects, our pitching prospects and hitting prospects. So the coaches are aware of who's down there and what they're doing. We get reports, we get check-ins, we have calls. Like what I've done is I have a group text chain between our Double A pitching coach, the Double A pitching strategist, and the same with the Triple A pitching coach and pitching strategist. And then we have our group at the major league level. So we'll connect every 2 to 3 weeks on some kind of a Zoom call, just kind of talk about the guys, see how they're doing. So we do stay connected that way. We get reports every day. Organizationally. So we know what everybody's doing. They might think they're, you know, in Double A or A ball or Triple A, and they're kind of, you know, out of sight, out of mind. But at the major league level, in every organization, they know who their minor league players are. And because they really are a phone call away. So you have to kind of know what they've been doing, how they've been throwing the ball, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are. You know, we have conversations about the running game with these guys. If someone's slow to the plate, we're like, you know, you can't come to the big leagues unless we fix this. So we are aware. Our Double A, Triple A pitching coaches especially, they know that they have an agenda with these guys. They have player plans with these guys, what they're working on, what they need to improve on. So we're all on the same page there. So we are connected. But my focus during the season, ideally, is the major league team, obviously. But we do stay connected with our minor league guys. We know how they're doing, what they're doing. Because, you know, as you know, in Major League Baseball, there's a lot of change. There's, you know, there's players get hurt, players struggle. So it's a constant revolving door with players with options. So we do stay connected on those kind of things.
But you're certainly not, you're not looking at video when a guy throwing it in single A and going, hey, yeah, I want him to throw his breaking ball more. Or he's striding across his body. You're not getting that. You're just aware of what's going on in the organization.
More how they're how they're doing their numbers. And we'll get velocity. We'll get, you know, spin rates, all that kind of stuff. But if someone's struggling, I won't be breaking down his delivery. We have other people doing that. But we will, there are times when we will see somebody, we're like, hey, what's going on with this guy? And all of a sudden our guys at the major league level, or me and my other guy, my group, we'd be looking at a video up on the big board and watching, you know, the pitcher in Double A, and we'll see something that we want to adjust or want to talk about. We'll bring it up with the guys down there.
Okay. I just had something I wanted to follow up with on that, which was, I'll get back to that in a minute. Let's switch to kind of the last, part, which was that, I pinch hit for you at the recent Mohegan Sun convention because you were leading a great segment, which I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the topic was sort of your idea.
It was.
Okay. So, yeah. Which is what I want to talk about. So the topic was really pitching versus throwing. Yeah. We had Chris Holt, director of pitching for the Orioles. We had Butch Thompson, the great pitching coach, head coach at Auburn. And then we had Mike McFerrin, who runs the pitching lab at Wake Forest. You had COVID. I filled in, really enjoyed the session. So I guess I put that question to you. When you think about that topic, pitching versus throwing, what types of things come to your mind, at, you know, in this day and age of where we are?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a great topic. It was kind of a fun topic. I just think, you know, as the things that I've seen, especially in the last several years, last few years primarily, is, you know, guys really, you know, you see on social media, you see on Instagram, you see these guys just pump. Everybody's working towards velocity, which is great because you can certainly dominate in a bat and put yourself out there, you know, with high velocity. But it just seems like we're getting away from making pitches and executing pitches and locating pitches. So I think that's always been a little bit of an issue with me and something I talk about with my guys, especially at the major league level and major league camp. I don't want throwers. I've seen it. I've seen a lot of guys with great velocity, with great spin, and we're talking about them in the lower levels of the minor leagues, and they disappear after 3 years. So it's because they can't throw enough strikes. They're not in the zone enough. And when they actually do, or they make these adjustments, you know, they're just not the same type of pitcher. They get hit around a little bit and they get to, you know, learn how to deal with that. So I do think location is obviously a real important part of pitching at the major level, especially with a strike zone that's, you know, it's minuscule.
Legit tight.
So you have to be able to, you know, expand a little bit. You got to be able to pitch inside. You certainly got to have stuff, right? You got to have stuff. But to be able to avoid bats, to be able to exit the strike zone at times in certain counts, to be able to pitch, you know, backdoor sinkers and be able to use both sides of the plate. So I just think I've seen a lot of guys come up with great stuff, and I see less and less guys that can really, you know, that can really pitch. Getting ahead in the count, controlling bat speed with front to back action, you know, good quality changeups. So I think one thing every team sees, I'm sure, you know, you got the iPads behind every bullpen session, and pitchers want constant feedback on the last pitch. Instead of learning, maybe I understand, you know, you want to know what the horizontal and vertical movement is, which is great, but not every pitch. Start to recognize what that was and be able to feel for it and be able to make the adjustments out in front. So I think that's part of it, you know, part of the issue I have with pitchers today. And you know, I'm fortunate at the major league level, I got Chris Bassitt and Kevin Gausman and Jose Barrios and guys that have stuff, but also understand that, you know, that's still changing speeds, making sure we're utilizing certain parts of the plate. We're getting strike one, you know, we're minimizing our walks. And so I think that's kind of a pet peeve of mine with younger pitchers coming up. And I see all these videos, or like I said, on Instagram or social media, and guys just, you know, getting into their hip and letting it rip, like we talk about, you know, they're just trying to throw 97, 98, and just, you can just see it's every ounce of energy they have, and they're just chucking it, you know, and it just, you know, it just, that's still, and it's going to get you an opportunity. Hopefully, you know, the delivery is sound and you're around the right people so you can have a long career. But it just seems like injuries eventually, I'm worried that down the road, are going to be on the rise.
Yeah, I mean, I think we know many guys like this, whether it's independent ball, lower levels. You're right. It's easy is not the right word, but it's get to the mid-90s now. There's a lot of guys that can do that, but who can actually get to the big leagues? Who can get people out regularly? Who can really be elite? It's more than just velocity and all that. Is the next level of feel and change of speeds and all that. So I guess the question that I had forgotten before relates to this, which hopefully will be our, you know, last one, unless you want to add anything after that, which is off-season-wise, you know, all winter, what is your responsibility with tracking the guys? Do you set up their plans? Do they have an ability to go to certain places if they want? How does that whole, you know, when they're not with you piece as a major league coach?
Yeah, you know, things have changed there too, which is great. When I was pitching, you're basically at the end of the season, you're on your own. You know, they might give you a throwing program and you're pretty much on your own until spring training starts, and you get to camp and they give you your medical examination and everything else. And they're like, you know, they really haven't set eyes on you for 3 or 4 months. Now, the facilities are incredible. We're fortunate in Dunedin. We have one of the nicest major league spring training facilities. So, and our high performance, our strength program is elite. So we have a lot of guys that actually stay down there now. which is really nice. And we have, you know, some of our pitching coaches are down there. We have the lab going on. We have strength coaches. So it's incredible to have that opportunity. Our facility when I was playing wasn't nearly as nice. You know, it wasn't nearly as welcoming. I got more out of throwing at Avery Point in the wintertime than trying to get down to our facility in Florida, because it wasn't quite the same. So they're very lucky from that aspect. But we stay in constant contact with our players, our hitters, our pitchers. We have some of our strength coaches actually fly to certain areas to check on guys and make sure that their off-season strength programs are going well. We get video data. We get clips, video clips of guys' bullpens, how they're throwing, making sure the deliveries are sound. We do Zoom calls with our pitchers as well. Like a group Zoom call, just to kind of touch base and kind of shoot the shit a little bit. Yeah. But so we stay in touch with our guys. So it is a lot different. And as far as throwing programs, they're all on throwing programs. It's rare that someone goes on their own. They're allowed to, you know, they can, right. You know, hitting and pitching, hitting more than pitching, but guys will have hitting coaches in the off season and make these adjustments. And pitching, occasionally they'll do the same. That's fine. You know, there's a facility. There's guys that reinvent themselves in the off season. You know, at certain facilities, which is great. So I think we encourage them to do, you know, to explore, but also just to kind of keep us in the loop if they're going to try something new or go to somebody else. And our guys have been great with that.
Awesome. All right. And the last thing then, is there any final thing that I, you know, should have asked you or anything else that you'd want to impart to a 14, 15, 16 year olds or anything that comes to mind that, you know, is a key philosophy, anything as a parting shot, if you will?
Yeah, I think kind of what we talked about, you know, for young high school pitchers, it's really owning your delivery. Obviously getting the most out of your delivery. So if you can increase velocity, absolutely do that with a good pitching coach, whether it's long toss and strength training, utilizing your lower half better. But I think the biggest thing that I see is the guys with quality changeups, whether it's, and I don't want to like push a split finger fastball, but maybe a modified split. I think pitchers today need to find a way to separate themselves and be a little bit different. And I think one way to do that is to have an exceptional changeup. I mean, I've seen Kevin Gausman. I've seen Jose Barrios. I had Marco Estrada back in the day. These guys dominate baseball with a changeup. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, and they don't have tremendous spin, although Jose Barrios has a good breaking ball. But Marco Estrada didn't have that breaking ball. And Kevin Gausman has that. It's really a changeup, a split change. But they dominate at bats, controlling bat speed. And I think we get caught up in four-seam spin, which is fine, and also just, you know, breaking balls, you know, really ripping sweepers and ripping hard sliders, which are good, don't get me wrong. But I've seen players – I know hitters, talk to hitters, and they would much rather face a guy with a good breaking ball than a good changeup.
I totally, totally agree. And, you know, I've seen it at the college level for years, a guy that's throwing – even low to mid 80s with a plus changeup, and you know, everyone's on the bench thinking they're going to go, you know, 3 for 4, and then they have these weak at bats and they don't know what's going on. And I also like what you said too. I think, you know, there's many different changeups, and a circle change, you know, sure, could be the best, but it's also one that takes a lifetime of feel, it seems.
Sure.
That modified split in some way is something that these guys can pick up and really learn quickly and have faith in and trust and actually throw in a disadvantaged count. Right. And, you know, that's something that really, I agree with you. And maybe, and there's a lot of guys that do have good ones, but maybe, you know, if we did a podcast in 10 years, maybe we'll be talking about how everyone's got nasty changeups and guys don't throw hard anymore. I doubt it, but
right. You know, we'll come full circle. No doubt.
Things change. Exactly.
But that's the other thing. You just said something really interesting about the, you know, pitching behind in the count too. I think that's real important. You know, being able to throw those pitches, whether it's a breaking ball or a changeup, I think that's when you really know you're a pitcher. You know, when you have the confidence in a 2-1 count or a 3-1 count, not to just give a cookie fastball, I think that's when you really learn about pitching. And I think that took me a long time to figure that part of it out as a pitcher. And now as a pitching coach, I like to really make sure that my pitchers understand that and have confidence. And if you walk a guy here and there, so up to be able to throw those pitches behind an account, and don't be afraid to pitch behind an account sometimes as well.
Yeah, I mean, it came up at Mohegan Sun. It came up in the last podcast with Butch Thompson. He tells a great story. It's worth telling again. Is he makes his pitchers 4 times a year stand up in front of the pitching staff and basically explain their identity. You know, what's their style? How do they get outs? And he said he had this kid who, like his first year, he spoke so long about his identity that the coach was like, you got to wrap it up, right? By the time the kid was an upperclassman, his identity was, I'm trying to end the at-bat on every pitch. And he was a mid-80s guy that he said was one of the best that he's ever coached with that mindset. Right. 2-0 count, I can end the at-bat on
right
a
here.
Yeah.
No exactly. Doubt. Beautiful. I love it.
Yeah. All right, Pete. You're a wealth of information. You're an awesome guy. Your whole family. I'm sorry we didn't connect in Mohegan. I'm sure we will again next year. And thanks so much for taking the time in the offseason. You got your family, and I know you've been busy with the team. So really appreciate your time. It was awesome having you.
That was a lot of fun. Do it again soon, for sure.
Hopefully. Thanks. Absolutely. All right. Thank you. Great. Thanks again, everyone, for listening to this episode of And That's the Game podcast, sponsored by Pro Batter Sports. We had our guest, Pete Walker, Major League pitching coach with the Toronto Blue Jays, and I hope you enjoyed it, and we really look forward to seeing you on our next episode.
For more information about Pro Batter Sports, visit them on the web at probatter.com.